but I read a lot about medieval Tibet and right up to the invasion by the Chinese in 1950, stylized debates questioning the very foundations of Buddhism and therefore of Tibet society were a central ritual in the monastic life. That is very beautiful. Can you compare that? I mean, compare that with what now goes on in Western universities. Sclerotic dogmatism being imposed on young minds, basically.
John Gray, you're renowned for your critiques of the Enlightenment and progress, and of course, liberal humanism and objectivity. Yeah. And as a philosopher, I share some of your criticisms of objectivity. And as the founder of II, many of the things that we are seeking to do is to explore what a world looks like when we don't have the ability to somehow reach through to reality in a straightforward way. Yes. So it is a great pleasure to welcome you here to How the Light Gets In.
It's a great pleasure to be here because I followed what you've done both in your own work and now here at the institution you founded.
Yes.
And I think it's vitally needed, partly because not very much of it, or in fact hardly any of it, is being done in academic life.
Yes. So thank you for that. So I'd really like to explore, you know, the philosophical underpinnings, yes, of your view, obviously, yes, given our outlook. And you put forward a very powerful and to many convincing account of human society, the human condition. But you are also critical of aspects of objectivity.
Yes.
And do you see there is a tension there? Yes. How do you support your own view?
There is obviously a tension because I do at times refer to historical facts. I criticize people who neglect or pass over or somehow neglect historical facts. And there are certain, I think, continuing features of what it is to be human that can be, I wouldn't say established, but can be discerned dimly through the evidences of history and common experience. In other words, I'm not one who takes the view that human nature is a misleading term, that everything we think about ourselves as being basic is somehow a construction that can be, or worse yet, should be deconstructed. I don't think that. But I think in this respect, I mean, there is the tension you mentioned, but it's also in many other philosophers that I respect. For example, one of the philosophers I got most from, whom I started reading in the 1960s in English, is Schopenhauer. And Schopenhauer was a radically skeptical Kantian. He thought that, as Wittgenstein, very influenced by him in this respect, especially in the first part of his philosophical work, thought that there's much that's ineffable, but not that there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. He wasn't one of those who thinks that there's nothing to be silent about. There is a lot to be silent about, and it is there. So what I do resist, I must say, is the outright relativization of human nature on the part of recent thinkers like Richard Rorty. And I tell you why I do resist. I resist it because it leads in practice always to a kind of presentism. It leads to a kind of reification and objectification of the ways of thinking we have now. You can't go further than that. And that connects with another fundamental feature of my way of, if I still do philosophy, of doing it, which is that it cannot be done unhistorically. Isaiah Berlin was a big influence on me in Oxford. He thought correctly that you can't do philosophy interestingly or usefully or productively if you don't do the history of ideas. R.G. Collingwood, earlier philosopher, a kind of critical Hegelian, I would say, almost, thought the same. So I resist the out-and-out relativization, that as it were, there's nothing to be silent about.
So you are obviously, you know, critical of some of the strategies of the Enlightenment.
Oh, yes.
For example, the use of reason and so forth.
Yeah.
Do you therefore not want to call on those strategies in defending your own view, just to continue that sort of thought?
Well, I mean, I've been criticized for an aphoristic way of writing that I've adopted, which has been identified by many people as signifying a certain paradoxical, they would say, in telling for an avowed skeptic, dogmatism. I just sort of say things.
Mm.
But that's really as much an aesthetic choice for me as an intellectual one. But there is an intellectual aspect, which I'll come to in a moment, which is that when I published Straw Dogs, which I think was in 2001 or two, anyway, about 20 years ago, it was in part from a wish to write about philosophical questions in a different way, more like that maybe of Nietzsche or Lichtenberg or any of these other aphorists. And that is connected with something deep, which is, I strongly resist the Socratic method, at least as it's portrayed now, the Socratic idea of philosophy as the use of dialectic to affect persuasion. I'm not interested in persuading anyone from or to any particular positions. I'm interested in stimulating a process of thought. And that involves shaking up their way of thinking in some ways. It involves pointing out how culture and time-bound it is, and that's connected with this constructivist momenting modern philosophy.
You do come over as you're trying to convince people, though. It's very convincing. Indeed, Straw Dog was a remarkable book.
I was introduced right about that time to J.G. Ballard, and we became friends until he died. And he said to me, every sentence packs a punch, which is one of the best compliments I've ever had. So that's true. And it might be paradoxical, but most of my very lack of interest in convincing anyone of anything maybe enabled me to state my own thoughts in a way that, if not convincing, I'm not sure that they convince anyone of a worldview behind it, but they certainly shake up the worldview they've got. And I do have that goal, but that's all. What moves human behavior is need and desire more than belief. And I share that view with Freud, who in turn derived it partly from his clinical experience, no doubt, but also from Schopenhauer. Because what Schopenhauer says is reason, or as I'm now talking about belief, is like a kind of a servant. It's a domestic servant. It does what it's told to do. And finding out how that works and illuminating, I think, is extremely interesting and does enable whoever does it moderately successfully to have a clearer view of the human world and of themselves. And that's worth it by itself. So it might not affect any other change in the world at all.
But you do, in all of those things, have a notion there of there being a clearer view,
yes.
You know, that there is an end point. And yet...
Not necessarily.
Right.
You think so?
It sounded, in the way the vocabulary sounded
as you're an
element.
It's not necessarily an asymptote. And also the process of inquiry is initiated in lots of different, quite different circumstances.
Mm.
So even if there's a pragmatic asymptote, a pragmatic endpoint, it only tells you about that local part of the universe.
I see.
Or even the human universe.
So would you, in terms of that local account, do you think that our theories and language are referring to reality? Do you have that sort of traditional sort of philosophical realist version of language?
No, because as I mentioned earlier, I mean, to use very old-fashioned terms, I'm a pretty radical nominalist. That's to say, I think words are, and concepts even, and frameworks of ideas and so on are, I wouldn't say tools in the narrowly pragmatic instrumental sense.
Yes.
Because they grow of their own volition.
Yes.
They're invented and elaborated. They're like spider's webs. They have an underlying set of functions, if you like, in sustaining the spider and providing a home for the spider. But they're not adopted consciously. I'm going to have this set of concepts. It hardly ever happens. They're inherited and modified, and then events happen and so on, which can destroy them or at least greatly disrupt them. So, but I do identify myself with an Occamist Hobbist philosophy of language. But I'm not a philosopher of language I haven't been in any extended way, so I haven't written as much as you have done on it, for example.
Yes. Of course, I put forward a metaphorical view that language is a metaphor for the openness of the world, which I think has some points of affinity with the...
one philosopher who has influenced me a lot and who is known to the current philosophical world only for one line in Wittgenstein's Tractatus, in which he says, "I think this," brackets, but not in Mountner's sense. That's Fritz Mountner, who is an enormously popular, widely read philosopher in Habsburg and post-Habsburg Vienna. And he was a radical nominalist. He, I think, invented some of the metaphors about language that Wittgenstein himself uses. He emphasized, as strongly as Wittgenstein did in his early work, how provisional, how partial, how instrumental language is. But I see the deep reason why I resist the view that concepts, the post-Kantian view or the Whorfian view or that concepts constitute reality, is that I think it's anthropocentric. It's a type of human solipsism. I'm very resistant to the reification of any human point of view as constituting reality. That's why it's a sort of solipsism. I'm a radical nominalist. Use words, but don't, what would you say, Countess of Wise Men or the Money of Fools or whatever in Hobbes. I'm very resistant to that.
So, I mean, you read philosophy as an undergraduate, postgraduate.
Yes. In Oxford, yeah.
Yeah. But one of the things you'll be aware of is that the mainstream of philosophy in the English-speaking world takes a very different approach to its relationship to reality, as it were, than you do. And why do you think that is? And is it sustainable?
It's hard to sustain it in a world in which so much is irreal, to use Nelson Goodman's term. Not unreal necessarily or delusional or illusory, but technology has made it harder to take those traditional views. But although philosophers claim, in philosophy of science in particular, to claim to be deeply cognizant of and influenced by science, it's, I think, in practice, they aren't that influenced by it. I mean, the actual scientists, Heisenberg, for example, was very influenced by Vedanta, by the non-realist traditions of Vedanta. So the actual scientists don't seem... Why it is, I suppose, a hangover from, in the British case, of Lockean empiricism, also the fear of anything that sounds mystagogical or... the lack of any strong phenomenological tradition of the kind that Husserl and others developed in Europe, and Heidegger, of course, in a different way. It's part of the national culture. It's more surprising in a way. Well, in America, it's associated, I guess, with, inconsistently perhaps, with a certain kind of temperamental pragmatism. We want it to be able to do things that are worth doing. And that even is an animating force in anti-realist philosophers such as Richard Rorty. I mean, the problem about Richard Rorty is I met him, by a charming man, delightful man. He'd never met an intelligent non-liberal. He'd never met one. So he didn't think there were any. I think, oddly enough, that Rorty takes over from the Enlightenment, of which he's otherwise quite interestingly critical, this view that that basically to deviate from liberal values is just error. Error. You just want, and if you're enlightened by reasoning, you'll give it up. That hardly ever happens. I try and express myself in ways that are forceful enough to disrupt or defamiliarize the point of view of most of those who read my books. But no one reads my books, I think, unless they're already somewhat skeptical to the idea that their way of life or their way of thinking may be flawed. But you see, what does flawed mean if there isn't something for it to be flawed about?
Hmm. So, I mean, one way of understanding what is going on for Rorty and for Derrida, and I'm also critical of
them, both of them, yeah,
is that they're trying to be consistent about having not having an overall story,
yes,
as it
yes,
were.
Yeah.
And of course, the criticism is that, well, this allows anything to go,
or it becomes a narrow story of its own.
A narrow story of its own. But just to come back from your own position, the question is, what is the alternative? Because you have many of the same motivations in terms of your assessment of the history.
Yeah, the alternative is what Montaigne called essays, trials. Humanity is a word or a term or a concept like any other, which is useful in certain contexts and not very useful in other contexts. But that partly means what attracts, because having a sort of semi-stable or semi-fixed idea of what it is to be human is on the one hand necessary, but if you become too sclerotic about it, it means that you can only describe other human beings who might turn out to be the majority of the species in different ways as non-human. I'm interested in this respect, by the way. There are some very interesting stuff written about the Aztecs. I mean, they're so different from us. I think it's in so many different ways. When the conquistadors first arrived, they were amazed at the cleanliness and order and aesthetic grace of the city, so the Aztec cities. But of course, they also practiced cannibalism and slavery and public torture.
So those are just radical cultural variations. Point to radical cultural variations,
yes,
in
but
our response
for them,
to that.
It's very hard for them, and this would very hard to resist the thought, if you come from a Western tradition, that they've somehow not fully realized.
No. And we're at the high point, looking down on everyone.
Looking
else.
Down, they say, yeah. And that's what that's what I try to loosen. But you can only loosen it if you think, well, for one thing, that these cultural variations are real, empirical.
So,
as it used to be called,
just in terms of understanding your approach, as it were, approach isn't the right word. Maybe the
method,
your motivation.
Yes.
One way of seeing your writing is that you are a radical critic of the Enlightenment, and therefore, in a way, of the establishment.
Yes.
And
of the establishment.
In part, that would traditionally, of course, put you on the left in the way that we think of the left.
Yes.
And yet, your instincts in terms of political theory are with Burke and Hobbes, who are traditionally on the conservative right. I'm not going to get too hooked on those.
Yes.
So, how do you square those very different
tensions? The left projects in Europe and in Britain have pretty well all been Enlightenment projects, have they not?
Yeah.
So why I didn't turn to the left? I mean, I was an old Labour voter for many years, but that was, in a sense, conservatism on my part, because it was an established tradition by that time, somewhat corrupt in the Northeast from where I hail, but in a humanly acceptable way kind of corruption. But my deep-seated objection was to the very idea of a rational plan of society. I think there's a direct link, historically as well as logically, between people who think that society as a whole should be planned according to a certain pattern, and dictatorship, because it simply comes up against the diversity not only within society, but within every human individual. Because every human individual has conflicting and contending impulses and needs and thoughts and images and so on. Squeezing that into a kind of overall plan is inherently tyrannous. So that's the reason. Now, of course, that can happen on the right as well.
Yeah. Are there, as it were, like, two sides of your personality, as it were. One is wanting to shake things up and challenge the mainstream, challenge the Enlightenment, all of those sorts of things, lots of exciting and powerful criticisms of that. And there's another side of it that is in favour of stability and order and so forth. And they feel as like they're two different personalities. Do you ever feel that tension yourself? And would you accept that description?
To a degree. I mean, there is I forget who said this. I think I remember now. It was a Russian Fideist Jewish writer, Leo Shestov, who said, anarchy inside, order outside.
Mm.
Now, I think it's a lovely idea, but it's not practical because there isn't order outside. And the order outside that he wrote of vanished in Russia completely and was replaced by a new, more constructivistic order, which had its own built-in irrationalities and insanities. Mm. But it's true, a society which can permit a high degree of skeptical, playful, ironical, intellectual life while maintaining certain traditions, which of course are not blind, they're only as blind as a bat is blind, is, I think, an ideal society. I tell you, I mean, of course, obviously I can't verify with that, but I read a lot about medieval Tibet and right up to the invasion by the Chinese in 1950, stylized debates questioning the very foundations of Buddhism and therefore of Tibet society were a central ritual in the monastic life. That is very beautiful. Can you compare that? I mean, compare that with what now goes on in Western universities. Sclerotic dogmatism being imposed on young minds, basically.
So, when you describe the liberal humanist Enlightenment view as a sclerotic dogmatism.
Now, certainly.
Which as I say, in many ways, I would agree with. There's also a way in which it could be seen as stable and in favor of sort of order in the way that elsewhere, politically, you're in favor of. So,
well, because how this works out in politics is, I remember hearing an interview with David Cameron, no great thinker, but he responded, so he said, oh, that's just populism. Now, what that struck me is that he doesn't understand the basic fact, if you like, I can use that term, fact, or the basic function of populism is a liberal term for a political backlash against the social disruption produced by liberal policies, by imposing liberal policies on society. That's what it is. So if you don't understand that, you just see this inexplicable outbreak of destructive madness. And then if it takes on, you say, well, that's demagoguery. Demagoguery's done that. So if you could only remove the demagogues, so you have no explanation of the world around you. Why is it? I mean, I've been arguing like this for about 10 or 15 years now, and all along, people have been saying, this is an anomaly. It was an anomaly. Brexit was an anomaly. Trump Mark I was an anomaly. Will a national rally government in France be another anomaly? Or all these movements all over? They all reflect certain shared, at least in Wittgensteinian, common resemblances, family resemblances, very common pathologies, which a certain kind of sclerotic liberalism or sclerotic hyperliberalism has brought about. So the trouble with representing it, which many liberals do this, if we give this up, we'll just have utter chaos. They don't understand their own role in creating, they have no culpability, no sense of responsibility for the chaos that they've actually initiated around them. I mean, let me put it into what are culture wars? We don't want any more culture wars. People on the left say this all the time. You know, culture wars. But what are culture wars? Well, if you change the way people are supposed to speak, the way they perform in sports, what their children can be taught at school, if you change all these things and some of them resist, that's a culture war. Well, all it means is that this is a very uncomfortable way for many people to live. It's disrupting the spire as well. So that's my answer to that, which is that it's the sclerotic dogmatism of hyperbolic.
But isn't there the
hyperbolic or liberal mind?
But isn't there the counter?
It has produced the chaos.
But isn't there the counter that if we accept your criticism of liberal humanism and say, well, this is a challenge to that, and you're shaking it up, isn't there a risk that then that generates a situation which doesn't produce the stability and order in culture that you'd like to see?
Mm. I don't think stability and order, I mean, I'm in culture, certainly not of a monolithic or monistic kind is either possible or desirable anymore. So I differ from many people on the right on that respect.
Right.
It's just not possible, not viable. It would involve mass conversion and deconversion, remigration, horrible things that would only produce lots of hatred and suffering and despair. So the I don't think that's possible anymore. We've got to learn more to live among fragments, which is what in fact we do. We are living among fragments. Actually, just be own up as to what that means. It also, of course, greatly simplifies our view of the past if we think that there was a period of in European history, Western history, which was, after all, the West. How old of an idea is it? I mean, maybe it's a Cold War construction, but if you wanted to take it back to the much further, it would be a theological distinction between Eastern and Western Christendom. Take it back to 1030 or whatever the Great Schism happened. So whatever the West was or is, it was born in conflict. It was born in these internal contradictions over how to interpret a certain received missionary enterprise, if you like. So I don't share that aspect on that view. That's why I like Hobbes, because Hobbes, he was a monist in a certain sense. Certainly his view of human beings is too simple. For example, he thinks bare existence is what most people want more than anything else. Not true. I mean, he brings about an idea of truth. Many people will give up their lives for duels in the 18th century to promote. Many people, I would even go so far as to say, make meaning in their lives by killing and being killed. So it's grossly oversimple. But in terms of the society that is governed, there's no aim in Hobbes to go beyond what's necessary for peace, civic peace. You don't try and unify everything. You don't try and get everyone to believe the same thing, or you don't try to restore a lost cultural unity, especially if it's impossible, which it is throughout the West now.
So just a final question in the time that we've got. This festival is called How the Light Gets In, and I imagine that you might not like this title very much. Does it feel as if it's rather unnecessarily optimistic in its character?
No, I interpret it in a different way, maybe my own idiosyncratic way, which is that I think you have to look at the dark to see the light. In other words, if looking for the light means turning away from the dark,
yeah,
that's a bad move.
Yes,
because you may not be interested in the dark, but the darkness is interested in you.
Well, in fact, we are very interested in that, because the line that it comes from is a Leonard Cohen song, and the one before it is, there's a crack in everything.
Yes.
That's why how the light gets.
Well, I love the fact that there are cracks in everything.
Yeah.
If there's anything salvific in the world, that's it.
Yeah.
Because it means there won't be an AI god.
Yeah.
There won't be any of these horrible, immutable utopias. They all break down. There's always rust. Rust is the savior of us all.
Yeah.
And what goes with rust is cracks and fractures and so on. And they're built into the nature of things. And so I think we've got to look at the, got to be ready. But not to look only at the dark, on the other hand, is a mistake. Nietzsche was right about that. If you keep looking only at the dark, it looks back at you, and that's not very good either. The abyss looks back at you. And so you have to be able to do as a few thinkers, I think, not so much Schopenhauer, I think. I think he's too metaphysically pessimistic for me. He's ruled by a single mood, a big mistake. Whereas,
many people would think of you as being metaphysically pessimistic.
Well, that's because I'm in a culture saturated by optimism.
Yeah.
Or have been. I mean, for example, when I talk now about, if you talk about decline, civilization decline, there are many people who say, well, it hasn't happened. But even those who accept that it has, take it as a pedagogic term, they can't accept that there might actually be irreversible decline. And I think that's why I like Greek tragic drama and Shakespeare. Shakespeare is not an optimistic writer. I mean, he writes beautiful, light plays, and there's no underlying...
He's certainly not driven by an ideology.
No, and there's certainly no underlying metaphysics of optimism or of Christianity, actually. It's amazing how free of Christianity, all of these. I mean, I'm not, I admire Christianity in many ways. I'm very impressed by Augustinian moral psychological realism, and I also like the I think the biblical inheritance, especially the Old Testament, actually is a very profound part of our culture. But what it has done, especially as it's been secularized in the Enlightenment, because Enlightenment is, I mean, there were thinkers that Enlightenment propagandists like to identify as Enlightenment thinkers in the ancient world. But if you read Lucretius, he's completely indifferent to the suffering. He speaks right at the start of his famous poem of watching with a mixture of indifference and pleasure a boat sinking with all the people in it. No one who'd been brought up in Christianity could have said that. So it's this kind of Enlightenment as we know it is a neo-Christian project or set of projects. I think it's better either to go the whole hog and become Christian again than go on with all this nonsense.
Well, John Gray, it's been absolute delight talking to you, and once again we're delighted to have you at the festival.
This is a wonderful event, and I encourage everyone to see what has been done here by you initially and by all the people you've roped into it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.